Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to the show. We have two very amazing guests this week, starting with David Phillips, who is a senior climatologist for Environment Canada. He's going to be talking about all the wacky weather that's been going on the last several months around the world, including the very warm weather in Canada and the early tornado season in the U.S. We also chat with career management expert and author Ginny Clark. She tells us how we can channel our childhood passion into our current career goals and objectives to have a more fulfilling life. We then wrap things up with a great remix from Madonna, Girl Gone Wild.
Capture your need for sound.
It has truly been a wacky couple of months with the weather around the world, and a lot of people are wondering what is going on. There have been record snowfalls in certain parts of the world and extremely warm weather in areas where there should still be snow, not to mention severe weather in sections of the U.S. where several tornadoes have touched down, wreaking havoc and destruction. To give us some insight into Mother Nature's wacky weather patterns this year is Environment Canada's senior climatologist David Phillips and author of the Canadian Weather Trivia Calendar. David, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, thank you, Kelly. I appreciate you having me aboard.
David, I know almost every year people make claims that the weather was wonky and different than it should be, but this time it really does feel that some normal weather patterns have been completely turned upside down. For example, the unusual warm weather that's been going on in the northern U.S. and Canada the last several weeks.
Oh, absolutely, Kelly. You know, I've been in this business 40 years, and I'm always careful. I mean, people always think what's happening out their window seems weird, wild, and wacky, and I can top everybody's weather by stories that I have over the past. So I guess when you follow all of the strangeness of weather, you almost become immune to strangeness. And yet, you know, I have just shaken my head over the kind of a spell of warm weather that we've got here, particularly in the northern part of the United States into Canada in this middle of March. I call it March mildness. It's almost madness, too, in the sense that what we have seen. And it's sort of equivalent to seeing, a tornado in Winnipeg a hurricane in Winnipeg, which could never happen, or snow in Washington or Toronto in July. I mean, it is so bizarre, and on several accounts. First of all, what we're seeing is the duration of this kind of March heat wave. It's covering a good chunk of North America. The intensity of it and the duration of it. It's going on day after day. You know, here in Canada, we are the second coldest country in the world and the snowiest. You do get in March a few incursions of mild air coming from the United States. Typically they're measured by, you know, 3 or 4 degrees maybe above normal. They get into maybe low or mid-teens, and they disappear after 1 or 2 days. It's sort of almost nature seducing us to think that winter is over and summer is on its way. Well, I mean, that we know by past years that April's the cruelest month. We have a return of winter, and my gosh, that was just something that kind of was inclement, but hey, it was nice while it happened, but hey, it was just kind of a false spring. Well, this one is almost as if we've gone from winter to summer, and the temperatures that we've seen are record amounts, all time, the highest temperature ever, into the kind of temperatures, instead of these temperatures that you'd see on the first day of spring, these would be typical on the first day of summer in many areas. But, you know, adding to the wackiness we've seen in the United States, an early start to the tornado season, more tornadoes in one day than they normally would get in all of March, some deadly tornadoes. We've seen incredible storms in Hawaii and of course, this past winter, while North Americans were enjoying, the fact that it was almost the non-winter. Winter was canceled. Yet in the mountainous parts of British Columbia and Alberta, we saw record amounts of snow for skiers. And of course, over in Europe, my gosh, winter seemed cruel. They got some incredible cold waves, a lot of deaths associated with that because they're not equipped, they're not used to it, and also some heavy snow. So it's almost as if nature was picking out its worst possibilities here and challenging people across the Northern Hemisphere.
And I wanted to touch upon the fact that it was, you know, warmer in certain parts of Canada and the U.S. Does that actually mean that our spring and summer is going to be blazing hot? Because that's a question that I've been hearing quite a bit, like, oh my God, our summer must be so hot.
Yeah, you know, but I've also heard the other way, Kelly. I've heard people say, oh my gosh, there's only a certain number of good warm days in allotment, and we're now using them all up, and it'll turn out to be that summer will be colder than normal. Some people just don't think it will trend to warmer. They just think that, oh my gosh, we'll now pay for this. You know, it's that Puritan thinking about, especially Canadians, you know. We think two good days are followed by four bad days. In fact, in Newfoundland, Labrador, it gets pretty extreme. If they get four good days in a row, they it's reported that Newfoundlanders stay indoors because they think Mother Nature is lurking around the corner to beat them up. Well, weather doesn't work that way, Kelly. I wish it did. We'd have this thing all figured out. You know, if warm winters were followed by cold summers, well, then we would probably, our predictions would be much better. But no, we think that the trump card is held by Mother Nature. You can get some real surprises. A warm winter could mean a cold summer. It could mean a hot summer. As it turns out, in Canada, we think, and in good part of the United States, the forecasts are calling for, at least in the springtime, April, May, and then into June, July, we're calling for warmer than normal conditions. Now, not as torridly warm. I mean, warmer than what we've seen in the recent days, but after all, that's three months or 4 months from now. But in terms of the departure, where we've seen temperatures that have been a dozen or two dozen degrees warmer than they should be for this time of year, we're not extrapolating that to suggest the temperatures in the middle of the summer and the dog days of summer would be 24 degrees warmer than they normally would be. Let's not hope that, or we'd be cooking eggs and baking, frying bacon on the sidewalks of Ottawa and Montreal.
And, you know, something else that struck me, because you mentioned it just a few moments ago about the tornadoes in the States. I've always sort of been fascinated by tornadoes. I'm not quite sure why, but I am. And so it seemed a little odd to me in the fact that the tornadoes did seem to start a bit early, because I always seem to think that they always mainly start in April for the residents of the U.S., and they were having these really deadly and destructive ones way earlier. Do you know what's going on with that?
Well, Kelly, you're right about that. I mean, April, you're so right. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that the deadliest tornadoes in the United States, for example, the Tornado Alley, they're the most tornado-prone country in the world. They see, on average, around probably 1,000 tornadoes. Here in Canada, we are the second most tornado-prone country in the world, and we see probably around 60 to 80 tornadoes in an average year. And there's every month has tornadoes in the United States. There's no off season for tornadoes there. And they move around, and often February is the peak month for tornadoes in Florida, for example. And then as what you need for a tornado is, a lot of people think you just need warm humid air. Well, if that was the case, you'd have a lot of tornadoes in the tropics, and you don't. What you need for a tornado is really a mixed bag of weather. You need that warm and humid, you need that cool and dry, and you need a jet stream over top. You need kind of almost like a mix master mixing all that together to produce the kind of spinning winds that you see in a tornado. So what we normally see in the United States, the most number of tornadoes occur in May. The deadliest ones, meaning the most severe ones, occur in April. And here we had this year, we've had some tornadoes in January in the United States, but certainly March was really just a terrible year, and widespread, a lot of tornadoes and deadly ones too, not quite as bad as April of last year in Joplin and Tuscaloosa. We saw probably well over 550 Americans dying from tornadoes last year. So it really has been a tough kind of 2 years so far. And I think it sort of comes to the fact that what we saw in March, the United States was one of the warmest winters they've ever had. So March was almost like April. Everything was an early. So the ground had been warm. The vegetation was now transpiring. And then, of course, you always still have the cool air around, because the Canadian air and then the jet stream. And so that's created that mixture that typically would be more mid-April, and you saw it in early March. I mean, it doesn't mean the season's over. We could still, it tends to move about. And here in Canada, we tend to wait a little while before we get our tornadoes. We've already had a tornado watch in Windsor. There was a tornado in Michigan just last week, and there was a warning in or a watch in Canada. We typically get our peak season in the prairies, for example, would be late to end of June, July. In Ontario, we normally get late May and June. So it kind of moves around. It's when you can expect both that kind of almost the battle between the warm and humid air and a bit above the cool kind of dry air that gets together. So in the United States, you find the number of tornadoes seem to die down in July and into August, because of the fact that the warm and humid air is there, but the cool Canadian air is, and dry air is just not as prevalent as it would be. You get tornadoes in those months, but the numbers seem to go down from that kind of late spring period.
And in your opinion, David, do you think the U.S. can expect more severe storms as they march into April and May? Like, is it over for them or probably not?
No, I think it's just really a beginning. I think that it maybe won't be as twisty and as severe as we've seen in March. One never knows. It really depends upon, you know, if there is going to be that battleground between the warm, humid air and the cool, dry air with some jet stream winds to mix it all together. I mean, that's still the potential there is for that to happen. The fact the season's started a little earlier, that you could only say that there's the potential there for it to be a long season because it started early, but certainly it's not, again, an allotment of these things. Some years you have a lot and some years you surprisingly have very few. And we also know there's some research to suggest that when you have a wet fall, wetter conditions there, it tends to create a greater chance of having spring tornadoes, because the wet ground is sort of one of the ingredients that you need to create these tornadoes. So no, I don't think they're out of the woods at all yet. And of course, here in Canada, our season is about to begin, certainly in April. In Windsor, Ontario, for example, where I'm from, they've had tornadoes one of the worst tornadoes in 76, took down a curling rink there on April the 3rd and killed about 8 or 9 people. So we certainly do get our share of those, but the season typically comes a little later. But so we're coming up to the severe summer weather season here in Canada.
Joining us on the show is Environment Canada's senior climatologist, David Phillips, and author of the Canadian Weather Trivia Calendar. David, what about the high snowfall that some areas receive this winter? I know parts of, like you said, British Columbia, Alaska, they sounded like they were essentially buried at some points, and then over in Europe as well. And it seems like these people were totally caught off guard by this.
Well, I think they were. I mean, especially when so millions and millions of North Americans were sending out search parties looking for winter. I mean, essentially from Alberta through to Newfoundland and down through all of the United States, there was an absence of winter. One of the best years ever for holidaying in the southern part of the United States, and people certainly, compared to the last couple of years, there just wasn't the appearance and the stinginess of winter. And yet the reports you were hearing in Alaska, record amounts of snow, record cold, and a bit of surprise, because just wasn't newsworthy, I guess, for many North Americans, is that there was a lot of snow in the ski resort areas of Canada. I often said to the resort owners, you know, you should be promoting yourself, because if there wasn't snow in Colorado and Utah and places in the United States and here in eastern Canada, I should have had a marketing campaign telling people come to the west, the far west. And again, you know, the kind of conditions that we were predicting this winter, the La Nina, which is a cool water in the Pacific, and generally for the northwestern part of the United States and into western Canada, produces a colder and snowier than normal winter. Well, what happened was that for British Columbia, the cool air was there. They turned out to be a little cooler than normal, the only area in Canada that was that way. But what happened, Kelly, was that the Arctic air, which was pent up there, always is there, didn't make its way down the jet stream, which is the border, the line between the warm air to the south and the cold air to the north, was much further north. It was almost in its summer position across the territories in northern Ontario, northern Quebec, and kept the cold air pent up way to the north, and it spilled over into Europe. It wasn't totally absent, but it took a different direction and didn't get down into Texas, where sometimes it can flow. And so these warm Pacific breezes, the American air just kept coming northward and pushing the cold air, and the cold air was not eager, didn't seem to be wanting to fill every nook and cranny across North America, and instead went the other way across Europe and into Siberia, and created a lot of unfortunate conditions there because people were not—they're not used to it. They were surprised by it and not equipped as North Americans are to face the kind of winters that that we're used to. So it was really just the weather patterns were such that they were set up that we see those in some years, and this year was particularly noteworthy. A lot of that cold air up in Alaska and that, any precipitation that did come just fell as the white stuff just day after day, and also seemed to blanket the resorts of British Columbia and Alberta too.
David, you know, weather definitely seems to be a hot topic these days. And with this sort of wacky warm weather that's been going on in North America, I keep hearing the words global warming sort of bandied about. Does this hold any water for you?
Well, you know, it's a tough one, I think, Kelly. I mean, I think what we're seeing is this high variabilities, these wild swings, these extremes are very much what we would expect with a warmer world. You know, this is almost for North America, this lack of winter, this cancellation of winter is almost a bit of a kind of what I call it like a weather trailer, like a movie trailer. It's telling you what's coming. It's sort of like a little dress rehearsal, a little teaser as to the kind of weather we see normal in 50 years from now. I mean, to try telling Europeans that the global warming is a real threat, given the kind of winter that they've had. So I think it's, I often say, Kelly, you look out the window and you see weather, you don't see climate change. Climate change or global warming is measured over decades, half centuries. Now, we do know, no question, Kelly, that the world is getting warmer. Every location, every ecosystem, every environment is showing a trend to warmer than normal conditions, some a little faster than others. But it's not as if we can say that North Americans would say, okay, well, this year is warm, this no winter. Next year we also mean no winter. No, I mean, it could turn around and be totally the opposite. It's just the fact that we have this variability, these wild swings. And I think, to me, that's the key thing. A lot of people talk about the extremes in global warming, and we see more of these, and that could certainly be a sign that the world is warming up and you get more volatility. But what you're also seeing, Kelly, is variability. This idea where you can't figure out what the seasons are going to be. It used to be, when I was a kid, my God, the summers were warm and the winters were cold. It's what your teachers and parents told you it was going to be. And now what we're seeing are these huge, wild swings. I mean, let me just give you an example. Here in Ontario, I often describe the Ontario weather in Ontario and southern Quebec as you know, that probably if you always get the weather you expect. If you don't get rain with this system, you get it with the next one. And a lot of reliability, a lot of dependability for farmers. And so that makes that particular profession kind of easier than it would be in other areas where you can get droughts and flooding years like we saw on the prairies. But, you know, in the last 10 years, I think the toughest profession here in Ontario, Quebec, has been farming. Because farmers can't figure out what the season's going to be. They're seeing some of the wettest growing season, followed by some of the driest. Something you might see over your lifetime as a farmer of 40, 50 years, where you can remember the driest year in the 30s and the wettest years in the 80s. Well, what you're seeing is back-to-back those things. Whatever happened to normal weather? And I think that that's maybe a better sign of what we're seeing now. Not just the fact that winter has been canceled or it'll turn out to be a hot summer. Those just happen, but it may be, and it's a trend to what we'll see more of in the future, but I don't think you can pin one storm, one month, one season, one year, maybe even a decade on climate change. It's there, it's coming, but it tends to be in a slow motion kind of thing, not a dramatic kind of thing that we're seeing. It may be that we're seeing it and we just are so stupid that we can't make the call, but scientists are always reluctant to pin it on that when they know that it could turn right around. And how do you defend it next year when it turns out to be colder than normal?
As a climatologist, I wanted to ask you, have all these sort of weather variations the last few months been challenging to wrap your head around, or can you sort of analyze and see specific reasons why we are having the weather that we're having?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, you can always explain the weather synoptically. You know, for example, the kind of winter we had. Well, we had this Arctic high was weaker, and it was more positioned, stayed put, and it was more dominated by mid-latitude events. La Nina, El Nino, these often to help to explain the kind of of seasons that we get. But I think there's so many factors that affect the weather, Kelly, that you don't know which one is going to be the dominant one. It's sort of like a marathon race. And in that race that everybody is packed together and you just don't know who's going to lead the way. And then all of a sudden somebody breaks out of the pack and takes off and people follow it. And that person is the dominant one that wins that race. Well, it's sort of like saying, well, La Niña, El Niño. It's sort of like that lead, you know. But in some years you have El Niño, La Niña, like you have, like this year. But then there's other things that cause the season that you're going to have. And so you're not sure which one is going to dominate it. You kind of point to La Niña and El Niño because those are clear and those are emerging well before the winter, for example, begins. But then when all of a sudden winter shows up, it could be some other factor, like the disappearance of the ice in the Arctic, for example. I think that's having a profound effect on weather. It's happened so dramatically that we're just learning about the effect that that will have. Have that thinner ice, that smaller area of ice, and it's. I think when the truth be known, when we finally analyze that, it will be one of the big factors that are causing this kind of almost wackiness that's happening to our weather, where we're finding the seasons are becoming unpredictable. I don't think the day-to-day weather is less predictable. I think we're even getting better at that, Kelly. But what seems to be the wild card, the joker in the weather deck, are these seasons, or the fact that we can't get the seasons right, or we have these wild swings from one year to the next. And of course, that's what we need to plan for. And you know, we plan everything based on normal. We plan our holidays, we build buildings and hospitals and schools based on normal weather. And what we're not seeing so much in recent years is normal weather. And that's what I think is beating us up. That's why farmers go from prosperity to bankruptcy, and retailers are just absolutely, some years you make it, and some years you just absolutely have all that goods sitting on shelves like this winter, and you can't deal with it. You know, you almost go bankrupt. So I think there's some real challenges out there, and I think it may very well be climate change, but I think it's showing itself up in not just warmer temperatures, but strange, bizarre, flip-flopping, yo-yo kind of weather.
And David, are there sort of hot spots around the world for 2012 that you're sort of going to be focusing on, thinking that they might end up having severe weather, whether that's going to be a hurricane or a tornado or, you know, a tsunami? Like, is there places right now that you're concerned that they might be affected this year specifically?
Well, I think certainly. A couple that I know about in North America, for example, there is concern. For example, the forest fire season in Canada. The Canadian Forestry Service is saying things are extreme situations, well above normal, from Alberta right through to Newfoundland, and an early start again. You know, I mean, a good spring rain, a couple or two would help to eliminate that. On the prairies, we saw so much talk last year about the flooding. This year, it may be about the droughts. The fact that so much of the insects. One of the great things about Canadian climate is that our cold winters kill all the vermits and varmints and diseases and parasites and weevils and ticks and things like that. And it almost resets the clock and really does give us a lot of safety for the summer. Well, with those creatures like pine beetles surviving the winter and thriving, well, then we may certainly see issues there. So drought would be possibly an issue, again, where we talked about floods last year. Forest fires, again, always severe weather is an issue that you have to deal with. I think the hurricane season for North America is of concern. The water temperature is much warmer, one of the ingredients that allow these thunderstorms to develop in these massive storms. So one would think that we might see another active of hurricane season. So that bears a watching. And certainly in the far north, the disappearance of the ice, we see another year where we'll probably have record low ice concentration, and that will have consequences for other seasons to go. We all have our crosses to bear with weather. Sometimes it's tame, and other times it's quite boisterous. It's hard to say, you know, a season ahead as to what you're going to be facing. I always think that if we can adapt to the kind of weather that we've got, and if we can be prepared for it, and I think that's the key thing for people to realize, is they have to be their own weather person. Just don't depend upon the weather service or the media to provide you with forecasts. When you start out for a day, take take a look at the sky, you know, observe the sky. It'll often, nature always gives us a forewarning before it gets us, and always have a game plan. If you're going to a picnic or you're going for hiking or something like this, know what the weather you're going to face that day and know what to do. Educate you and your family as to the kind of conditions that will lead to a problem, and have a game plan that you can go to safety and not be a statistic of the weather.
And I'm assuming that this crazy weather that we've been having will make some sort of appearance in your upcoming edition of the Canadian Weather Trivia Calendar.
Well, it's interesting, Kelly, and maybe not this year. I'll tell you why, because what I'm working on right as we chatted today is the 25th edition of the Weather Trivia Calendar. It's kind of a milestone in a way. So what I've chosen to do is to look back over the last 24 years and take my favorite story of each day and kind of repeat it. I always am proud of the fact that I don't repeat stories. But this year I thought, for those people who have just seen it once or twice, there are some stories that will curl your hair. I mean, absolutely are just shockers and mouth droppers, and things about fish falling from the sky, or, I mean, not that lightning would turn man into woman. I've never had any of those kinds of stories. But I think there are some things that will be just so unbelievable and all factual, all I can verify. So it's going to be kind of like the best of the 24 weather trivia calendars in this kind of a silver anniversary edition of what has become the most popular calendar sold in Canada and still alive. I love producing it, and so this year I'm not got any new stories, but they're my favorites of all the previous calendars.
And when is it going to be released, David, and where can people get a copy?
Well, Kelly, it's available typically, well, probably even August, or certainly by Labor Day. And it's all found in favorite bookstores. People in Canada love it. And we even get calls from people. Canadians love to send it to other parts of their friends in other parts of the world. And, of course, I had the Prime Minister Mulroney once said he didn't want this calendar hanging up in any trade offices or immigration offices overseas, because if people looked at it and saw all this strange and crazy and extreme weather, they would think Canada would be an inhospitable place to live. And he's probably right. I mean, we never chronicle the good weather. It's only the bad weather, the tough weather. And of course, we're tough weather customers here in Canada. We like to think that we can handle almost anything, and so this is what the calendar is faced with: no blue skies and white puffy clouds. It's mostly about the misery, hardship, and misfortune that has befallen us because of weather, which is for us still the most important topic of conversation among Canadians.
David, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kelly. Enjoyed it. Maybe we'll chat again sometime.
You got it. That's Environment Canada Senior Climatologist David Phillips and author of the Canadian Weather Trivia Calendar.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
I'm always on the lookout for some new and cool music, and an artist that has come to my attention recently is Lea LaBelle. You actually may remember her because years ago, she did compete on the third season of American Idol. She came in 12th place. Now, all these years later, she's hooked up with some very cool producers, Pharrell Williams and Jermaine Dupri. You may know that they have worked with A-list celebrities, including Mariah Carey, Madonna, Justin Timberlake, Janet Jackson, TLC, Usher. The list goes on and on. And they are working on this artist, it seems, together, because she has signed to their I Am Ether and So Def record label imprints. And so it looks like it's going to be quite the project that they're putting together. And her first single is called Sexify. And I really wanted you to hear it. It reminds me of some 90s R&B, just, you know, taken up a notch so that it does sound current. So take a listen to Lea LaBelle. I think we're going to hear big things from this artist, Sexify, right here on The Kelly Alexander Show. I got a whole bunch of ways.
I'll sexify you. I got a whole bunch of ways. Turn him on, girl. He'll come home, girl. If you know what I mean. A whole bunch of ways. All in your tone, girl. He'll come home, girl. If you know what I mean. I just want some hanky panky. Sexy versus skanky. Ooh.
If you take a moment and look back at what you wanted to be when you were a kid, maybe a police officer, a pilot, or a marine biologist, did you give up on those dreams and settle for a more practical line of work? Was that a sensible choice, or should you maybe have kept trying to follow your passion? To give us some advice on how we can channel our childhood passion into career goals today is career management expert and author of Career Mapping, Charting Your Course in the New World of Work, Ginny Clark. Ginny, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Kelly, thank you so much for having me this morning.
Ginny, now so many of us have clear ideas as a child what we want to do when we grow up. Why do so often those dreams sort of get left in the dust?
Well, as children, we haven't had exposure. And yet there's a purity to our thinking based on the limited exposure that we've had. And, you know, so many people will say, oh, well, you shouldn't do that. Parents and teachers and counselors and people with really good intentions who say, oh, you're really good at this and you should pursue that. And, oh, that's not going to pay you enough. And all these value judgments that are sort of loaded on to these innocent thoughts. And so they're often abandoned and it can be kind of unfortunate.
And so is it more sort of social pressure, I guess, that persuades us to abandon those dreams, you know, of becoming that fire, like that firefighter or that fighter pilot? Or in the end, do we sabotage ourselves because the path to get there might be sort of extra challenging?
Oh, I think it's both. You know, I know plenty of people who, and I'll take myself as an example. I wanted to be a veterinarian growing up because I loved animals. Now, I was a suburban kid, and all I had was a dog, a couple dogs, and I worked in the vet's office. But from the time I was 12, that's all I wanted to be until I went away to college and started studying that. And after a couple years of, actually one year of animal science and chemistry and all that to be pre-vet, I thought, this just isn't me. It just isn't. So let me get realistic. And then I ended up majoring in French and linguistics and discovered that that wasn't going to take me very far. I actually knew that. But it was a good foundation. So I think, you know, people should get a great education, indulge yourself in college if you can, and in other ways, and give yourself the exposure to that thing that's always been a dream, and then see where you can take it.
Over the years, it seems, you know, very easy to bury your childhood dreams for adult responsibilities. If you are feeling unfulfilled, you know, in your career, should you channel some of your younger passions? And how do you sort of resurrect those dreams?
Well, in my book, Career Mapping, one of the first phase that I ask people to go through with their map is to plot the historical aspects of their work lives. And for young people, that can be college years and what you studied and what you loved and extracurricular activities and academics. So look at that, all of that, and see certain trends should emerge. And I don't know that, I think there are assessment tools that can do some of this, but I urge people to layer in some of those assessments that say that you were always really good at language or always great with your hands and very artistic. And don't leave that on the table. Look for ways to integrate that into different roles and jobs and positions that exist out there, combining maybe if you have an interest in the arts, maybe you do want to work for a not-for-profit art organization, or maybe you want to work for a for-profit corporation that supports the arts. I mean, there's a lot of ways to integrate aspects of your passion into what it is that you think you might want to do.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, sometimes teachers and adults in a child's life, or even, you know, as you're into young adulthood,
yeah,
sort of say, you know, you're really good at this, you know, you should do that. How do you maybe sort of step away from that, even if you are good at it, but it's really not where your heart is? Like, it seems like it's a really tight rope kind of walk to make.
It can be, and yet I'm a big, you know, I'm into self-actualization, right? And that often means that you need to just completely mute all of the outside sounds and just listen to your inner voice and figure out who you are. And you need to do this regularly, because I don't know about you, but I'm not who I was when I was 15 or 25 or even 35. I'm very different now, yet there are some common elements about who I am that have always been there. But some of my desires and dreams as I've grown and explored the work world and just, you know, personal relationships, we don't live in a vacuum. My father's death was a big defining moment for me. And I kind of got his messages after he passed and thought, you know, what am I doing? How am I going to make something for myself? I can't place responsibility or try to please other people in this entire process. It's just too important. You get one crack at it. You can change your careers, mind you, but this is your life and you have to make these decisions. No one can make them for you.
What do you say to people that get trapped in the cycle of like family history? And I mean, like, let's say, you know, grandpa had a restaurant and son has done it and now you're the grandson and you need to keep going, but you really don't want to.
Yeah, that's rough. I know some people for whom that's been the case. And I think that's where courage comes in. You know, I think you have to sort of do a deep dive into yourself and say, what can I really bring to this situation? And what do I want? Where might this take me? So maybe there's a compromise that you make with the family that says, look, when I come out of college, I'll give you 5 years. And yet this is what I want to get out of this responsibility that you've or this obligation that you've asked me to take on. I want to learn XYZ aspects of the business. I want to be in finance. And I want to parlay that into something else that complements what I went to school for or where I see myself going in the future. So again, maybe you can satisfy certain, you know, familial pressures. They're real, and I'm not suggesting that you walk away, but it does take courage to stand up and say, if I'm going to do this, I have to do this on my terms. With all due respect to the family and the legacy, this isn't my highest and best use, and I wouldn't be true to the family if I tried to force fit this, right? And it just, your happiness is paramount, and that should be what your family wants for you. And sometimes it's a real tough conversation to have, but seek compromise.
Joining us on the show is career management expert and author of Career Mapping, Charting Your Course in the New World of Work. Make sure to check her out, mycareermapping.com. It's Ginny Clark that's joining us on the show. How do you actually weed out, you know, maybe some potentially unrealistic childhood goals with ones that are actually attainable?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm 6'1" and a very healthy woman. Yeah, I wanted to be a ballerina at one point. Guess what? It just wasn't going to happen. I took ballet until I could get on point, and my size 12 shoes were just not going to be, they weren't going to work. So my doctor had to say, look, your feet are not designed for ballet, so give it up. So sometimes it's that smack in the face, the harsh reality where there are physical limitations, there are other kinds of, it's just, this just isn't meant for you. And again, you know, just be honest. This is where you might have to listen to other people who say, you know, time to abandon this dream. It's not going to happen. You've got athletes who invested so much of their life in training into being an athlete, and their professional careers are very short-lived. So think beyond, you know, where this sort of dream might take you. Look past the sort of window in which you might be able to do this thing that you've always thought about doing, and give yourself options. I'm a big believer, and in my whole mapping process, I'm suggesting to you, as you look at your aspirational roles, don't just pick one, pick up to three. But do it based on having analyzed the industries, the functions, the roles, and having looked at your historical map to help you identify those competencies. And then you look at some of your fears and your personal attributes and layer all of that into some of the few choices, and then do your research and explore those and really analyze whether or not, do a gap analysis to know if you're really up to snuff and you can perform those functions.
Ginny, is it important to have someone in your life that you can go to for the truth? Because I know that, you know, just as you mentioned about being a ballerina, I know that for a while I thought I was going to be Janet Jackson's backup dancer. And the person in my life who basically told me to get over it was my sister, who is very sort of in your face and just, you know, just tells you how it is. Does someone need that? Because sometimes I feel like, because I am in the entertainment industry, I have managed to do that part of the dream by being a radio announcer. But I find in my travails as being in entertainment, you know, I've had to cover reality singing competitions and all that sort of stuff. And I see contestants who, it's like, I'm always like, where's your mama that told you you really can't do that?
Right. Yeah. Yes, you absolutely need those people. So not to contradict what I was saying about, you know, sometimes just be quiet and push away some of the people that want to tell you what you should be doing. The flip side is you do need a core group of people whose opinions you can trust. and they're part of your network. And I'm very clear in the book about having a strategic network that's made up of 8 different categories of people, and one of those is advisors, mentors, and sponsors. Another category, that's one grouping that of a category. Another one is family. And so you do need to listen to those folks and share with them some of your aspirations and your dreams and seek their feedback and ask for an honest assessment. Even in the workplace, you should be getting it from your boss. If you're not getting it from your direct supervisor, ask other people that work with you and actually know you intimately, whom you can trust, and seek feedback. It's really important to get that along the way. It might not always feel good, but it's really important to have.
Because I think sometimes you can get lost in your own head, right? So you need someone that you can trust to kind of keep you, like, in reality.
Yeah, big time reality check. Okay. Yeah, you know what? My son is almost 16, and he's good for that from time to time. I mean, even basic things like, if you know, I'll put on something, and he'll say, "Mom, really, you're going to wear that?" you know, it's like, how? What do you know at 16? Well, he knows a lot, actually. He has an opinion. And so I listen to him quite a bit for a variety of things. So
okay. Now, once you actually have some of your childhood passions lined up, how do you go about turning them into a reality, especially if, you know, you have family commitments like raising kids?
Well, this is where it's almost like financial planning, where, you know, I urge people to sit down and go through your career map a couple times a year, if not at least twice a year, if not 4 times a year. And assess where you really want to be, because that's going to change. You don't do this once and it's done. I've changed careers 5 times, and I'm proud of that. I did it successfully. It's not because I was flaky and indecisive. It's just I did one thing for a while, didn't like it, did another thing for 10 years, decided that wasn't what I wanted to do, became an executive recruiter for 12, and then became an entrepreneur 3 years ago. So I think you have to really assess and don't get caught up just in the dream for dream's sake. But, you know, really think about where have I been in my life? What were the things that I've been exposed to that gave me pleasure, that gave me passion, that I did well, that mean something to me, where I can be of service? So there's a lot of different components beyond just the dream aspect. And this, you know, this world of work that we're in, there's some harsh realities that have to be balanced with the dream.
And what do you say, Jenny, to people who... For example, I have a friend, he, you know, is very talented in computers and stuff, and I think could have gone on, maybe he seemed to have a passion for helping kids like in school with learning new applications and all that sort of stuff. Instead, he has, I don't want to use the word settled, but he's settled for this corporate job where he's making like severe amounts of money, but yeah. He basically hates the 8 hours that he's at work. How yeah. do you tell someone or have someone really sort of ask themselves, am I choosing the money or am I choosing fulfillment?
You know, it's such a personal choice, and this is not one size fits all. And this person might say, look, I have a 5-year plan and I'm going to make as much money as I can and just suck it up. And then I'm going to go off and do something else. I know several people who have articulated that, and I respect that. I worry about them sometimes because the toll that the work is taking on them is quite insidious and can be quite great, you know, physically and emotionally and mentally. So I caution people who say they're going to suck it up that the toll can be far greater, and money isn't everything. So, you know, it's quite a personal decision. But again, that's where I think having some advisors, some family members, some trusted people in your life that you can go to and say, look, I'm grappling with this. It might be, you know, someone from your church or spiritual circles that you go to in private and just say, I'm trying to figure all this out. It's not an easy decision. It's very personal.
Joining us on the show is career management expert and author of Career Mapping, Charting Your Course in the New World of Work, Jenny Clark. Make sure to check her out, mycareermapping.com. Jenny, if you are sort of capable to start charting your new course, is there a mindset shift that actually has to take place? Because I think a lot of people are programmed to think that the world is, you know, kind of unfair, and most mm-hmm. likely you don't get to have your dreams come true.
Oh, I just, that so saddens me. I just don't believe that. The world of work has changed forever. Let's start there, and then we'll kind of circle back to the dream piece of it. But I think there is a mindset that everybody needs to adopt, and it doesn't need to take on a cynical perspective, but it's a free agency mindset that I start the book talking about. There's several books written on free agency, and so it's akin to the sports concept of free agency. But in this mindset that I refer to, I'm really urging people, and again, it doesn't matter how old you are, you need to have this mindset so that you are a free agent. I don't care if you work for the same company for 15 years. That's increasingly rare and uncommon, but it's still happening. But even if you're working for the same organization for an extended period of time, you need to think of yourself not because they're going to lay you off and you're, you know, you're walking around in fear, but because you need to know what you're worth. You need to have a plan for what it is that you want out of that job that you're doing. If you want to progress and move up and get promoted in that organization, what's it going to take? And you can't rely on the organization to just keep, you know, pushing you along. You have to be able to say, this is what I need. This is what I want out of my employer. If I'm not getting it, I'm going to go someplace else where I can get that. And that goes back to going back and assessing your career map several times a year so that you can kind of say, well, you know, I'm not loving. I thought I was going to love this marketing job. I don't love it. Maybe there's a different kind of a role in the marketing area that I should be pursuing. What does that mean? Maybe I need to go network and learn more about that and then assess those kinds of roles against my competencies and skills and experiences. So the dream piece of it, you know, that's still out there, but you need a plan to get there if you're ever going to get to the there that there is. You know, my there never came in terms of becoming a veterinarian. It was my dream. I abandoned it, but it was my conscious decision. I scratched that itch now by having a dog, and I adore her. And it took forever to get another dog. But, you know, that's kind of my ode to veterinary medicine, is just kind of taking care of my little puppy. So, you know, find other ways. It might not be in the workplace, but understand that you do have to have that free agency mindset so that you're going to be successful in this really complex world of work that we're in.
Something I wanted to do from just even talking to you today is to really kind of shake people awake a little bit, because I feel like there's so many, and I have tons of friends that fall into this category that, again, have settled, if you will.
Yeah.
And it's important for me, I guess, because, you know, I am kind of, I guess, maybe left in the dust a little bit with other people, because I have chosen to voraciously follow, you know, my goal, because I've always wanted to be a radio announcer since I was 5. So, you know, it's been a difficult path, especially I've walked it alone quite a bit of the time, but yeah. I don't know what's in me. There is like this little factor that will not let me waver, even though I'm sure I could be making more money maybe if I was doing something else. And my dad even questions me sometimes. He's like, I sent you to university for this. So,
yeah.
But I feel happy by doing what I'm doing. And I just find a lot of people are willing to get into a rut and not see out of it.
They are. And again, it really makes me sad, because I think what's holding them back is stuff that really doesn't matter. It's fear. And yes, it can be a sense of obligation and money and all those things. But I think we just kind of think far too narrowly and say, well, I can't do that. And I just don't believe in that philosophically. I believe that virtually anything is possible, but you've got to be the one to begin to explore the possibilities. I had a guy say to me, and this is, it's related, but he had just lost his job, and it was in the real estate industry, which I spent 10 years in. And he said, well, why isn't something just falling in my lap? And I kind of sat back in astonishment, because I thought, wow, this guy's entitled. And I said to him, there were a lot of things I could have said, but what I chose to say was, why would you want that? Why do you think that something falling in your lap is going to be the right thing for you? Don't you know that this should be of your choosing? This isn't a game of someone finding you. And I was an executive recruiter, right? So I used to go out and find people. But I always respected the people who said, I'm going to take this position because it fits with where I know I need to be, not because I'm flattered, not because I think I'm all that, but because this is where I'm trying to go and this meets my needs. And that's where this guy was missing the point. And that's frankly why he'd gotten laid off, because he had a huge ego and was arrogant. And, you know, he was just misguided in thinking that the world owed him something. So, you know, I caution people to adopt that mindset, or to adopt it that I'm trapped and I can't go anywhere else. You're never trapped. Begin to explore the possibilities and just ask yourself, what if? That's what I did. And it took me to a whole new place, and it's been really gratifying.
And Ginny, in the course of what you do, do you find that there is a lot of people that have just stayed in the rut and aren't willing to get out? Because I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on if there are enough people having the courage, like you said, to step out and take action.
You know, I don't know what the numbers are. It's hard to say. Well, I can give you a statistic that I heard several months ago on CNN. It said that as the economy was starting to turn, just as the unemployment number was starting to dip down below 9%, there was a statistic that said that there were something like 2/3 of people, of currently employed people, said that they would consider looking for something else once the economy improves. And I thought, wow, I work with a lot of corporations, a lot of employers, and to think that they've got such a large percentage of their employee base who's not particularly happy, that's a serious business problem, right? Because
right.
that means companies spend millions and millions of dollars trying to recruit new people because of high turnover and attrition and all these things. So there's a real problem for the organization that they've got people sitting in the seats that don't necessarily want to be there. How sad is that? Nobody wins. You're unhappy. You're not doing good work for your company. You've got a negative attitude. You're demoralized. A lot of employee surveys, engagement surveys, are showing just a huge amount of malaise and demoralization. And again, it just doesn't serve anybody. So I vote for individuals. The company has got to do what they're going to do. The individual, you need to wake up and start deciding where you want to be. And you'll be doing your company a favor if you decide to leave, or if you decide to sort of take matters into your own hands and start seeking opportunities within that company where you can be more happy. It's not always that hard. If you raise your hand, start applying to postings, start exploring and networking with people inside your company to find new opportunities.
Ginny, what's your key piece of advice as a person tries to change the course of their life path sort of midstream?
The key piece of advice is to map it out, lay it out, and look at your past, present, and future holistically. And again, it's only you can do this. Don't try to hand this off to somebody else. Don't call a recruiter and say, I'm ready to make a move. Do the background work to know yourself, know what you've done, and to make some real clear choices as to where you might want to go going forward.
And where can people actually get a copy of your book?
Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Awesome. Ginny, thank you so much for joining us on the show this week. I really appreciate it.
Kelly, thank you so much. I appreciate you.
That's career management expert and author of Career Mapping, Charting Your Course in the New World of Work, Ginny Clark. Check out her website, mycareermapping.com.
Bring on the
Remix.
That's Madonna with Girl Gone Wild, the Happy Hot Dog remix on The Kelly Alexander Show. A big heartfelt thanks going out to my guests this week, including David Phillips and Ginny Clark. And as per usual, here is your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Anthony J. D'Angelo. Wherever you go, no matter what the weather, always bring your own sunshine. Thanks so much for hanging out. I always appreciate your time. Any comments or questions, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have a great week. You and I will chat soon.